Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will have information on how to beat holiday stress and an interview with an expert about systemic racism as it pertains to the death penalty in Ohio. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective...
The holidays are supposed to be a magical time, dedicated to making cherished memories, but amidst the festivities, the season can also be stressful. Juggling duties, shopping for gifts, and managing your time and budget can quickly become overwhelming. Now check this out, gang. 9 out of 10 U.S. adults feel stressed over the holidays. Elena Shipley is the head of Audience Insights and Consumer Insights. She's the expert from DoorDash, and she joins us on Columbus Perspective to work through all of this holiday stress. What are we going to do?
That is such a great intro there, Jay. I really appreciate having me today to talk with you today. I'm really excited.
So what are some tips for handling a long to-do list? What are we going to do?
The holidays, like you said, to-do lists can get endless. Things are stressful, and it's really hard to put it in the right order of how to address it. So for myself, I am really big on how do you start with the easiest tasks and check those off. Everyone loves a good check-off, and it feels really good to do. And one of the best ways to do that is starting off with the things on the list that you can do without leaving your home. So, for example, with DoorDash, you can order anything from groceries to alcohol to decorations to gifts. So I like to tell people, if you're an early planner, you can use DoorDash to schedule ahead. Have those things arrive whenever you want them to and get those checked off the list. But if you're like me, a little bit more last minute and the day of is when you're thinking about it, that's okay too, because delivery can get sent to you in under an hour. So you treat us like your secret holiday helper is what I highly recommend for people out there.
What holiday chores can we outsource that people may not consider? Because I know I have two things that I do. I clean before everybody gets there, and I clean as soon as they leave.
You're good at, I take a little time on that cleaning when they leave part. But I know that people think about us for restaurant delivery, but on DoorDash, you can get tech items, beauty products, home goods, groceries, all types of things. So one of the best things that you can actually use DoorDash for and outsource is ordering gifts for loved ones. Have it delivered straight to their door. You can add a personalized message, make it more thoughtful that way. Or you can actually, if you don't know what to get specific people in your life, we have a new gift hub this year where people can go and shop both physical and digital gift cards. Emphasis on the physical part, where you can actually have a person deliver a physical gift card to any address out there where it's available and have that recipient get that gift card in hand, which I think just adds a little special touch. If you're like me, where sending the digital one is a little bit hard, telling people the email address and things of that sort. And then the other thing that people don't think about with DoorDash is that you can actually have packages dropped off. So if you have loved ones that you aren't trying to get delivered their gift from DoorDash, but want to deliver things at UPS or FedEx or USPS, you can actually have a Dasher pick it up from your house and take it to those locations and have it shipped out for you. So we are really trying to make things super easy and get as many of those things off your list and outsource as much as possible.
Now, here in Columbus, we like to shop locally. So can we still do that even though we're using a service like DoorDash?
Absolutely. I'm from Ohio. Myself, I'm from Cincinnati, though, the other city in Ohio. So one of the things that DoorDash has prides themselves in is really supporting local economy businesses. So we do have the national favorites out there that I know a lot of people look at. But we do have family-owned restaurants, family-owned grocery stores. We also have local gift shops and all types of local stores. It's really hard to list out all the different ones that are available locally. So the best thing that I tell people to do, even if you're not ready to purchase already, go to DoorDash.com or go to the app, put in your address, and you'll be able to explore stores by the different categories and really plan ahead about what are those local businesses that you can find in there. I bet you'll be surprised by how many are on there.
So if you ruin Thanksgiving dinner, don't worry, because you can DoorDash a replacement. That's what I've heard.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I don't plan to ruin the dinner, but it's good to know. Elena Shipley from DoorDash, thanks for joining us. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
As of September 9th of this year, there are 114 inmates on death row in the state of Ohio. 9 are from the central Ohio area. 56% of those on death row are black, even though they only make up 13% of the state's total population. When you narrow that down to prisoners between the ages of 16 and 20, that number jumps to 66%. On October 24th, Kevin Werner, the executive director of Ohioans, says Stop Executions, spoke at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati about systemic racism in the death penalty in Ohio. He joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We have an understanding for what racism is, but let's start at the beginning. What do you mean when you use the phrase systemic racism?
Sure. Well, Ohio, like many states in the country, has a long history of having both laws on the books and practices that really skew towards discrimination of black people. These laws, these policies, have their beginnings back at the beginning founding days of Ohio. And so for as long as Ohio has existed as a state, it has had policies and laws on the books that were very discriminatory towards black people, both before slavery had ended and really after slavery. So the long history of slavery in the country and in Ohio really shows itself today in a lot of ways. One of those is through the death penalty system.
But yet Ohio was a free state.
That's right. And despite the fact that Ohio was a free state, for example, in the 1960s and really after slavery had been abolished, those Jim Crow laws, you know, certainly made their way to Ohio. So just because Ohio, being a northern state, being a free state, that doesn't mean that it's immune from some of the practices and the policies that were discriminatory towards black individuals.
There are a lot of folks that say that the Mason-Dixon line starts in Columbus, Ohio, and that south of Columbus, Ohio was more toward the Confederate viewpoint than perhaps the northern half of Ohio. Did you find that to be true in your research?
Well, certainly we see remnants of that, across the state. I mean, if you're in the southern part of Ohio, driving through some of what I think is the most beautiful and scenic parts of the state, you will see Confederate flags. If you're driving across the northern end of the state, you don't see those as much. And so, the remnants of some of that, I think, are still around and visible today. The other thing that we have to understand when we talk about how this system has played out is in a lot of ways, it is a county by county matter. And so a northern county may not have as prevalent of that sort of systemic racism as the southern county may, for example. So what we have to understand when we look at how racism has played out across the state with respect to the death penalty, it is very much a county by county sort of thing.
So why are black Ohioans so disproportionately sentenced to death? Is it that they're creating and perpetrating more egregious crimes than Caucasians, or is there another reason?
Yeah, the reason when you look at numbers, when you look at the data, what it boils down to is really two things. The first is the race of the victim drives the outcome and what that will be. So, for example, and sometimes the sex of the victim plays a role. If you're a white woman and you're murdered, the person who is responsible or alleged to have committed that crime is far more likely, like 6.2 times more likely to be given a death sentence. Right. So the race of the victim drives the outcome, number one. Number two, prosecutors in this state have discretion to seek the death penalty in virtually every case. And so we have to understand that it's prosecutor discretion that really drives some of those outcomes as well. Now, I'm not going to say that you know, prosecutors are racist, but what I'm saying is, when you look at the outcomes and you understand that the role of the prosecutor is to have the discretion as to whether or not a case will go forward capitally or non-capitally, it's really hard to dispute that those things are intrinsically tied together. So again, race of the victim and prosecutor discretion, that's what drives the outcomes.
How do we achieve what you use the phrase equal justice under the law? How do we achieve that?
Yeah, one really, really quick and easy example is, you know, an expert task force looked at this issue back in from 2011 to 2014, came up with a series of recommendations. Largely, those recommendations have been ignored. One of those recommendations would have ensured, well, there's really two of them that are relevant, but one would institute a system where it's not the individual prosecutor who makes the determination, but it's a panel of prosecutors. So take it from the local county level up to a state level. So it's almost as if the attorney general's office would need to sign off on whether or not a case would go forward capitally or not. That would address some of the uneven application of the death penalty. The second thing is a racial justice act was recommended, where a defendant could challenge a death sentence under the premise that the system in some way, shape, or form had racial bias toward that defendant. Now, they would have to prove that, and there's a very high bar to do that. But the whole point is two very easy to understand and simple recommendations were made. The state legislature has failed to enact, you know, really virtually all of them. A couple of them have gone into effect, but really not many. And so we're continuing to have these problems with the role that race plays in the death penalty system because the legislature hasn't addressed the issue.
Now, you advocate for the abolition of the death penalty in the state of Ohio. Let's say, for example, that is not a possibility. Could these recommendations apply to other types of crimes so that equal justice is actually served? Or is it just for the death penalty?
Yeah, the focus of the recommendations was certainly the application of the capital punishment statute in the state. There are some tangential things that could be improved. One example, you know, there's a man on death row today who's innocent. He's been proven innocent. His name is Tony Apanovich. He was freed from death row, but he was then brought back to death row after being freed for about 2.5 years because of a technicality in the DNA access law. Some of the recommendations that were made by this task force could address that, but, you know, it's sort of, it's an interpretation of how one would view that particular case. But, you know, again, our system has given us the kind of results where there's an innocent guy on death row. He was freed. He's been brought back because he's not the one who requested the DNA testing. It was the prosecutor who requested. So, again, the outcome is completely backwards. And these recommendations by the task force were not designed to address all of those other types of cases, but certainly there could be some benefit to some other criminal cases in Ohio through enactment of those recommendations.
So basically, it is up to the legislature to do something about it. And until they do, we're stuck with the status quo, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, the thing about the death penalty is it's enormously expensive. Taxpayers don't get a break on the cost. when the legislature fails to act. And so really what we see is just these enormous costs keep coming and keep compiling and keep building. And, you know, taxpayers are paying for this five different ways for decades on each individual case. But yeah, the legislature has to actually do its job and act here.
We want to thank Kevin Werner, the executive director of Ohioans to Stop Executions, for being a part of the show today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Walter Ted Carter Jr. became Ohio State University's 17th president on January 1st of this year. He says he has spent a lot of this first year listening to many people and forming his vision for the future of the university, a reimagined future. He laid out that vision during his recent investiture ceremony. Investiture is a tradition in academia dating back centuries that culminated with Carter taking the oath of office. Carter's vision focuses on turning out well-prepared students while embracing research, creativity, and innovation. He says if the university is great at academics, everything else will follow. His tenure comes at a time of advancements and opportunities, but also challenges. 10 TV's Angela Ann recently sat down with Carter for an extensive one-on-one interview covering a wide range of topics. Those include how the university is dealing with the costs of name, image, and likeness in college sports and attracting the best students and faculty. She started by asking him about year number one and his vision for the future.
You came in here, like we were saying, a year ago, but you came in ground running. You had a vision. How has this year been for you? Do you feel like you're on par with what you expected, above, below?
You know, it's still work in motion, right? I mean, I feel really good about the investiture 2 weeks ago and the momentum that we've gained from delivering a vision for the future of higher education, a vision for the future of Ohio State. I've heard from so many colleagues from all over the country. And then, of course, I've met with a lot of our faculty and staff. We just had a Board of Trustees meeting. We've got this unique moment of alignment where everybody agrees that the outcomes that we're going after, the themes that we've identified, the strategic framework that we've organized, and now as we fill it out with the details, ready to hit the ground running with an action plan on July 1st of 2025 that'll take us out over the next 10 years. So I'm very excited, and I feel good about where we are. We've gotten a lot done this year.
Talk about how will you keep that momentum going. It's very exciting now. People are looking at, you know, the bullet point list or themes. How will you keep that going starting in July and forward?
Well, everybody has part of the plan. And the approach I made to this plan was to be collaborative. In other words, this wasn't the Ted Carter plan. I did a lot of listening and learning over my first 5 or 6 months here. When I gave the State of the University address, it was much more focused on our past and our history, showing respect for that. But as we wrote out the strategic framework, we did it through these series of workshops where we touched well over 1,000 different parts of the community here, from our faculty staff, our students, our alumni, our business community, the General Assembly, our board. We wanted to do that so that people not only gave us their good ideas, I want to have them have a sense of buy-in to the plan. And I feel like we have that. That's not how a lot of these strategic plans are often drafted. It just pops. And that's why I didn't do it in the first 100 days. I want to have some time to understand the landscape here. This is a large, complex organization, 154-year history. And as great as we've been, I want to make sure that we're thinking a little bit differently so that we can be even greater in the future. My investiture that talked about excellence isn't a destination, it's an expectation. And I think if there is a theme other than education for citizenship, that was the phrase that I want people to keep going back to.
The expectation.
Yes.
How will you measure that?
So anything that's worth doing has to be measurable. And that's why I'm trying to create this idea of education for citizenship. It's really a call to a mission that we inherited in 1938 with that motto. So when we're talking about, you know, academic excellence, we should be able to measure what that success looks like. And it's not just success of the quality of the faculty that we bring in, the success of our students. It's also measured in the type of research and creativity that we're bringing here. Now, of course, there's always some amount of subjectivity to these things, but I want to focus on the objective parts of these. So as we develop this plan, we're also going to have measurables, and we will make those transparent to the public. And the reason we're going to do that is to achieve our goals, we'll have to make some adjustments, and we know that. So this is a plan that will be dynamic, and it will be cross-functional. So as you've heard me talk about academics and research and clinical care, operations, talent and culture, and even athletics, these things interweave with each other, and we've got to be able to think about it that way.
We look at college enrollment nationwide. It's been declining at many colleges. OSU, however, had its largest incoming freshman year. What do you think is the secret that is attracting more talent here as opposed to those other colleges? And how do you combat those declining numbers that we're seeing?
Yeah, and I've talked a lot about this publicly. 1.5 million fewer students across the United States in colleges and universities from just 8 years ago, 2 million fewer from 10 years ago. So those are real numbers. You got to ask the question, why? And part of it is the cost of education has gone up extensively, particularly in the private universities, the return on investment. And then there's even some discussion about, you know, whether we're doing the right things by educating our students and what do they get for it. So I think for us, we got to look beyond the graduation rates, which are very good here, 88% on 6 years, 72.5% over 4 year. What do they do after they finish with us? Are we giving them the right opportunity to look at internships and the job market here, which is growing? I mean, what a great place to go to work and live in Central Ohio. You're right. I mean, we took in 80,000 applications for that incoming freshman class of 9,530, largest in 154-year history. We won't probably sustain that level of incoming freshman class every year. We've got limitations on where we put everybody, faculty to student ratio, dorms, lab spaces. So there's a reality check to that number. We were able to grow that class because we slightly underperformed in years prior, and we graduated more. So I'm excited about that, but when you ask the question, what is it about Ohio State that makes students want to come here? And I would tell you it's the experience. It's everything that they get to do here. I just gave you one great example. We have 1,400 clubs and activities here. Mm-hmm. There is almost nothing that you can find of interest to yourself as a student that you can't be involved in. Of course, 36 Division I sports, that doesn't cover the multitude of club sports that we have, intramural sports. So we've got something for everybody. And then, of course, just the mystique of being on the Oval, to be in, you know, the shoe on a Saturday college game day. The whole experience of being here is why students from all over the country and from the state of Ohio want to be here.
You talk about sports. Let's talk about NIL, the big news this week. So NIL, very tricky. The toothpaste is out of the tube, so to speak.
Yeah.
What is your take on the fact that a lot of people are worried about the cost and the trickle down to students who will have to support this NIL plan?
Well, a number of points. One is we are in support of our athletes sharing revenue, and we have stated that that goes before my time here. I hired Ross Bjork with the understanding that this was coming. We haven't had the House versus NCAA lawsuit settled yet, but as our athletic director put out yesterday, we've got a plan. And we're being as clear-eyed about it so that people don't see what's the plan. What does it look like? So we're sticking to a couple of really important principles. One is we've got 36 Division I sports programs. We're one of the, if not the largest, athletic department in the country. We intend to stay that way. You know, we saw during COVID major universities were planning to cut sports, and what a mistake that was. And then they had to scramble to try to put them back together. So we know right up front that we don't want to do that. You know, there's a lot of talk about scholarships and roster. Roster limits are not controlled by us. That will be given to us. That's why we anticipate to have about 100 to 150 student, less student athletes when the settlement is done. But we also know that we're strong enough that we could actually increase the number of scholarships across those 36 sports. So that's what that announcement was yesterday. 91 additional scholarship spots. Some of those will be spread out because those scholarships will be offered through money to the coaches. So what that means is if I'm coaching fencing, for example, I'm going to use some of that money to pay less for a student from the state of Ohio to become part of the fencing team versus somebody that's from California, because that would be out of state. So there's opportunity here. But at the end of the day, what we're trying to make sure we preserve is the student-athlete collegiate model, meaning that when you come to Ohio State and you wear the Block O on your jersey, you're here to get a degree. Now, yes, some of our students will go on to be professional athletes. It's a relatively small percentage. I mean, much less than single-digit percentage. So we want to make sure that we continue to be one of the best in terms of academic performance, which we are. We just had our academic performance numbers come out yesterday. We're graduating our student-athletes at a much higher rate than everybody else on campus. They're all going to go be professionals, not necessarily in sports. So I believe in that. I played sports when I was at Navy. I know what it did for me in my life, and I know what it's going to do for our student athletes. So I'm excited about where we are and what we're able to do. And by the way, at the end of the day, no tuition or taxpayer dollars will go to support athletics. We will continue to do this independent of those dollars. We're one of the few programs in the country that will be able to say that.
Where will that independent money then funding source come from if it's not tuition and
Yeah, it's ticket sales and private donations. And then, of course, we have the ability to, you know, operate concerts and outdoor hockey games and some of these other things. We're going to look at our branding. We're going to look at all the things that we can to generate revenue and be more efficient. I mean, the athletic department is looking at their staffing right now to see if there's some efficiencies there. So, yes, this is a level of effort that's going to be complicated. But, you know, the fact that we can put 105,000 people in the shoe for every home game, that's probably the biggest help for us.
Carter says the university is in a very large, complex urban environment. With that comes challenges. Still ahead on Face the State, President Carter on keeping students safe on campus.
I want them to know that we're going to do everything to not only be safe, I want students to feel safe. Those are two different things.
Next, what Carter and the university are focusing on to make those two different things a reality. And later, keeping your money safe and earning more money for you instead of for your favorite payment app. Why an expert says you should not keep a balance in that app.
In honor of all those we've lost to cancer and those still fighting and thriving, like basketball analyst and cancer champion Dick Vitale.
I want to beat cancer. I'm going to beat it. That's no doubt in my mind. I'm going to win this battle.
Defeating cancer will take all of us. Join our team to help fund game-changing research that saves lives. At the V Foundation, V is for victory over cancer. V is for victory over the odds. V is for victory over health disparities. Victory over setbacks. Victory over the unknown. V is for victory over giving up.
Don't give up. Don't ever give up.
Donate to the V Foundation to join our team and help save lives.
Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind, it cannot touch my heart, and it cannot touch my soul.
100% of donations fund game-changing cancer research. Donate now to the V Foundation at V.org.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies. Because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with our hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
Hey, Alex, how did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom! I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project.
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations.
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. feedingamerica.org/act now. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Welcome back to Face the State. Now, more of our one-on-one interview with Ohio State University President Ted Carter as he wraps up his first year in office. Our Angela Ann talks with him about keeping up with growth, keeping students safe, and a hot topic in higher education these days, diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Where does that stand here now under your tenure?
Well, you know, we still have programs that support diversity, equity, and inclusion. By the way, those three words are in our core values and have been for a long, long time, and they will continue to be. You know, as I look at those programs, the first thing I always talk about is making sure that we're doing things based on meritocracy, which we are. Our hiring rules are all completely legal. We're all doing those things appropriately. These programs right now that we have on campus are there to retain faculty, make sure that we're attracting the best faculty and staff, and then, of course, everything about student success. The challenge with diversity, equity, inclusion is it's often people just immediately go to thinking about it's the color of somebody's skin, and it's much more than that. I mean, this is about disabled students, faculty, and staff, making sure that we have the facilities to care for them, veterans, single parents. There are many other elements to underrepresented or marginalized groups that are part of that, and we have them represented across our entire campus. So as I think about what the future of DEI is going to be, regardless of what we see in terms of federal statutes, executive orders, or state laws, I want to make sure that our programs are there for student success writ large, and again, to attract the right faculty and staff, world class, and retain them.
Student safety. I know that topic comes up all the time, and certainly being where Ohio State is located, you can't escape it. What bothers you the most about the safety issues off campus?
Well, we obviously live in a very large, complex urban environment. I mean, the city of Columbus and High Street and our campus basically merge into one. We have great collaboration with the Columbus City Police, State Highway Patrol, our own security teams. And yes, it's really important for us. Those relationships matter. We've been investing more in high-definition cameras, license plate readers, our patrols that we do collaboratively, we're increasing. And then, of course, we've got to continue to educate our students to know how to help themselves be safe. We increase the number of places where you can get a free cab ride, particularly after 9 p.m. So we're going to continue to keep working on this. It's not a program that is 100% safe all the time. It's very difficult to keep everything from never happening. I mean, things do happen, but we want to minimize them. We want to be able to try to anticipate those. And then when something does happen, make sure that we can hold those that break the law accountable. And we've been pretty successful with that.
I'm sure you cringe when you see a news story come up and you hear Ohio State off campus in some kind of crime.
It breaks my heart. And I hear from the parents. I tell them that I not only sympathize with their concerns, I want them to know that we're going to do everything to not only be safe, I want students to feel safe. Those are two different things. And the second one's really harder because you've got to show a lot of work there. You know, when you look at our statistics, and we are paying attention to that, we have become a more safe campus over time. But again, one bad incident is one too many, and we're just going to keep continually working on this. We'll never have an end state on this. We're going to keep working. We're going to keep investing in it to make sure our students feel safe.
Speaking of money, Chris Devine told the trustees, I think this week, that the projected revenues exceed what was expected by more than $63 million. Where does that money go?
So a lot of that money goes back into looking at programs for affordability. It allows us the opportunity to do more with the financial needs-based scholarships. We're going to be going through a full review of that because, you know, we're not a for-profit university. So when we have something that's positive on the ledger sheet, we just don't necessarily bank that money. We want to put that back and invest in the things that are important. So I'm happy that we did that, and that's mostly because we had a higher number of incoming students come in. But we want to make sure we're reinvesting that money in the things that matter.
So we have a Boomtown series on 10TV. Yeah. We look at the growth. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
Great. Glad to hear. We look at growth and how it really affects all of us, from housing, transportation, you name it. You talked about a lot of those issues. Where do you see Ohio State fitting as this region booms, and how you're preparing our students if they want to go into the Silicon Heartland or if they don't? Where is Ohio State's place in this boom?
Well, we are a community partner, and where I place myself physically, recognizing that we are a boom town. I mean, I think we're going to grow somewhere between 750,000 and a million new people in population by the year 2050. And if you think about this Education for Citizenship 2035, the next 10 years, we better be prepared for that growth that's happening over that period of time. So when I think of Ohio State, for us, there's growth coming, but growth with a purpose. In other words, as the population grows, we know we're going to need more nurses, more doctors, more veterinarians. We're going to need people that are smarter in the tech world, people that have that go into the workforce that have knowledge of artificial intelligence and what it means to have generative AI versus ChatGPT and quantum computing. We're going to have to make sure that we're educating for the right job market that we have to anticipate. But we also know that we're going to have to do things like have improved and a larger capacity for clinical care. So we're going to be opening up a new tower in early 2026 so that we'll be able to sustain taking care of about 1 in 4 Central Ohioans for clinical care going into the next 4 or 5 years. And then we may have to even anticipate, if that growth really comes to reality, how are we going to be prepared to take care of that clinical care for that growing population? So there's a lot to think about there. And we're already 1,300 buildings across 6 different campuses in Ohio. We're going to have to be smart about our physical plant as well.
And you talk about boomtown. Ohio State is its own mini boomtown, where you have a $3 billion project. We'll start with Carmington District. I mean, that's huge. And you talk about all that. I know research is big on your plate with AI as well. So how do you see that all coming to play?
Well, I'm really excited that our board approved us working with Tishman Speyer, who is a developer. We're going to start thinking about how we're going to develop that roughly 350-acre campus to become the research triangle for the country. It'll first start with making sure that the 2 buildings that we have that are completely full, working on building facilities to live, to work, to eat. That's the first order of business, and then we'll look at how that will develop. But it's more than just bringing in research dollars. It's bringing in the type of research that's going to benefit Ohioans. We're an agricultural state. We're in all 88 counties with extension. How does that play in with what we might build out there? So we want to make sure that we're not just thinking about medicine. How do we live in a cancer-free world, in the next 10 years? How we're also going to be able to feed 10 billion people worldwide by the year 2050. And a lot of that's happening right here in the state of Ohio. This is one of the most diverse agricultural states in the country. And I can say that coming from Nebraska, which mostly focused on cattle and corn. We got so much more here. We're 1 in 7 people in the state of Ohio are in that space. So it's all interconnected. It's all going to be for not only the benefit of our nation, but particularly because of our land grant mission, for the benefit of Ohioans.
You have a full plate.
We do.
Go Bucks.
Go Bucks.
Thank you, sir.
We also have Angela's interview posted on 10TV.com.
Teachers are dynamic leaders, shaping a new generation. They bring a variety of perspectives from diverse backgrounds, innovating how they teach to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Achieving this takes skill and expertise. They're tireless explorers, creatively discovering a universe of solutions, telling stories, experimenting, inspiring, mentoring, connecting cultures, and connecting with each other. Leading by example. Experience the unique joy of helping students thrive. Teaching is a journey that shapes lives. Are you ready to begin? Explore teaching at teach.org, a campaign supported by the U.S. Department of Education, Teach.org, and 1 million teachers of color.
We're moving closer to a cashless world, but this morning, a warning from experts. Be careful where you store your money. Consumer 10's Clay Gordon shares the risk of keeping money in a peer-to-peer payment app.
If you're like the many we talk to, you probably don't carry cash.
I use Venmo a lot.
I do use Cash App and Venmo.
How often do you use Venmo?
Probably like
4 times a week, 5 times a week.
A survey from NerdWallet found 79% of people use mobile payment apps, a convenient way for day-to-day transactions.
You don't have to do a wire transfer necessary to do that. And the second thing is that the fees can be relatively low, especially if you're not sending the money in the same days.
On average, users keep up to $287 in their apps, and nearly half of users keep more than $100. Only 32% of people say they immediately transfer the money into their bank account.
I'll transfer right away.
Why?
I don't know. They shouldn't have access to my money.
I always cash out.
I transfer it right away.
Around like $20, not much more than that.
In my Venmo, I think I have like $10 in it right now.
But Elizabeth Iola with NerdWallet warns, don't wait too long to transfer that cash.
Not always the best idea for one primary reason, and that's that these peer-to-peer apps a lot of the time are not FDIC insured. And what does that mean for the average consumer? It means that if the app goes bust and it goes bankrupt, or, you know, it's not in business anymore, all of your money could essentially be gone.
Iola says you should be making money off of your money, not the app.
These apps sometimes work as banks, so the money that you leave idly in there, they might be investing in the stock market. That's how they can make some money themselves.
You go throw in a little high-interest savings, build something on it, and why would I let it sit in Venmo?
A high-yield savings account is definitely a low-hanging fruit. It's low risk. It's not investing. It's just somewhere that houses your money, and you basically get passive income just from having your money sit in there.
It's time for you to start making money off of your money. For Consumer 10, I'm Clay Gordon.
NerdWallet also recommends using multi-step authentication. Keep changing your passwords and your PINs, and double-check that the person you send money to is the person you want to have that money.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.